Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Robinanda Bennett. And again, just like last week, we do not have Emily Burke in the studio, which is honestly something that's really disheartening to me, but I'm learning how to deal. I'm learning how to do all this recording on my own, and it's daunting, but I think we're going to make it through it again. So shout outs to Emily Burke and shout outs to Rob Bennett, because that dude is involved in so many different things, and I'm really excited to have him on the show. He's an artist manager, he does a lot of promotions, and he's really entrenched in the heavy world. And I don't know, when I think of the state of Colorado, I don't often think of heavy, I think of chill. So there's going to be some, I guess, little dichotomy. That word has been utilized by me quite a bit recently, dichotomy, and I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. I just got back from Paris, so maybe I've been coming a little bit more pretentious than I'd like to be, but I digress. So the next few weeks on Waldman's Words, we have some cool guests. We actually have Will Stevenson, who was part of the company Artery, which was recently sold to Warner Brothers. So hopefully we can get in some of the nooks and crannies of that entire ordeal. I'm having like a lisp now, and I don't even have a lisp. This is really weird. Today something is off, but this interview will be on. We've got Moshe Isaacson on the following week, who has been involved with so many different social media forays. Dichotomy foray, I don't know what's going on today. This interview is going to be fucking awesome, using all these big multi-syllabled words. Moshe Isaacson knows a lot about the ins and outs of various social media, I guess, tools. The word tool is often used in a negative way, so just many facets of that industry. And we usually have a lot of people behind the scenes in, you know, the management world, the label world, the agency world. Last week we had someone who has his own blog. I'm really interested to talk more about technology, because it's 2017 and the industry is completely different now than it was even a few years ago. I mean, Spotify playlists weren't a thing then, and now it's pretty much the industry standard. So next few weeks are going to be pretty rad. Rad almost rhymes with rab. Rab is on the show. Colorado is so fucking rad. Their marijuana laws are rad too. I don't get too political on the show, but I love Colorado. It's a beautiful state. Very beautiful people. I think it's the fittest state. So we're going to try to learn as much as we can about rab, about Colorado, about every facet of what he does, because we often say this on the show, it's a hyphenated job a lot of the time. Even the biggest managers in the world have, I guess, their tails in different entities. So Rab's going to talk about that. So stick around for Waldman's Words with Rab Bennett and be a good person. Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Robinanda Bennett. What's up, buddy?
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
You know, I'm actually really in a really good mood. It is a lovely day in Los Angeles, and you are in the even more beautiful state of Colorado, correct?
Indeed. I'm in Denver right now, actually.
I love Denver. I've had a really, really good foray there. Does the Marquee Theater still exist?
Yes. Yes, it does. The Marquee is one of a few venues that Soda Jerk owns and operates. I work with that room as well as their Summit Music Hall and the Moon Room that they book a couple blocks up the street from the Marquee.
Well, before we talk about you, because that's the primary focus of the show, I just want to let you know that there's this band called Single File. I'm not sure if you're aware of them, but they were, yes, a band from that area that I think they were coming up around the same time that 303 came around, but I, yes, thought that they were a severely underrated pop rock band.
They were very, very good. It was around the same time, like 303, and I feel like The Fray, Breathe Carolina, all kind of took off. Colorado had a really good and hot scene that was just kind of all really developing at the same time in multiple genres.
I mean, that's just really rad, because I remember when I was a full-time touring musician, the thing about Colorado is you get there, you play a show, and then your next stop is like 8-9 hour drive.
So in either direction. Yeah.
You're really isolated, but I guess with that isolation creates a really healthy subculture, and I'm a fan of the Green Party, so you know what I'm saying there. So anyway, so did you grow up in the state of Colorado? Like, what's your background? We've only spoken on the phone one other time before, and so I really want to learn about you, just like the tens of millions of listeners or the tens of listeners do.
Well, I've kind of grown up all over. I was actually adopted from Calcutta, India, when I was 3 months old to Colorado. I lived here for the first 4 years of my life and then moved to upstate New York, and then moved to New Mexico when I was around 13, moved out of the country. I moved to the Northern Mariana Islands down by Guam.
Wow.
I lived there for a while. My mom, when we were in New Mexico, attended UNM School of Law, and she met a couple of women from down there, and my parents, being the incredible hippies that they are, they thought it would be good for my sister and I to grow up outside of the U.S. to get a better appreciation of what we have here within the country.
So it sounds like you're not very well versed in traveling or living in different places. It seems like you've only been exposed to one culture in one land. It sounds like you really haven't.
And honestly, I think had a huge part in my ability to be so comfortable being on the road in a different city every day. I think that was a huge part of it. And growing up, I mean, they took care of multiple foster children too. So I think that watching them take care of 6 or 7 kids at a time and getting us all ready for school, and it just kind of made sense to me when I started doing similar things for bands on the road in terms of managing their logistics and scheduling. It just kind of came naturally because I had that example at a very early age.
I never thought of it that way.
I moved back to Colorado in 2004 for school.
I never thought of it that way, though, but like being a tour manager or managers, I mean, I often say that it's like being a doctor, lawyer, therapist, but it's also like being a foster parent because they're not always with you, and sometimes you go from person to person, so I feel like I should just interview your parents. They seem like way better people than most. I mean, that's pretty badass. I'm honored to know someone who is birthed by people that took care of other people. I always say that, you know, obviously there's so much money with what we do behind the scenes, but like, I think that if I ever acquire a lump sum, I would love to adopt. I think it's a beautiful thing to do. So props to your parents for being badass motherfuckers. Sorry, just want to say that.
They definitely have a different take on life. And I mean, growing up, my mom had 2 kids from her first marriage that are 20 years older than me, and then all the foster kids, and my sister, who's also adopted from New Mexico. My father didn't ever really want to have any biological kids of his own, and he now has 2 9-year-old twins that are test tube babies that are 20 years younger than me.
Oh my God, that's an entire generation. I mean, yeah. I don't know exactly how old you are, but I do know that I'm 36, so am I like Generation X? I don't even know. Like, I think there's even new astrological.
I'm going to be 32 in January, so I think we're like Y or X. I think we're up there.
I mean, I always ask myself why, but we're probably that and X or whatever. I always say that we're the Nintendo generation, so I'm going to.
Yes.
I'm going to own that, and Super Mario 3 is the best video game ever made. So if your parents were very, very liberal hippies, I'm sure that they're very stoked about the current administration.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no shortage of jokes. Both my parents have had multiple discussions with me about it and how I feel about it being a brown guy, right last name.
Yeah, I mean, it's my last name is Waldman. I'm not brown, but I guess I'm technically Middle Eastern by that descent, and it's just crazy what's going on for people who are not WASPs in America. So I digress. Let's talk about things that are actually fun. So where did you spend, I guess, your formative years? Because I just listened to you say this a few minutes ago, and I've already lost track of the 730 places you've lived. So when you were actually, like, old enough
I lived,
to have a Discman, like, what'd you do?
I was in New Mexico, and we had just moved probably out to the Northern Mariana Islands, and I had really, really, really gotten into music. I mean, my parents said as I was growing up, I was a collector. I collected sticks and rocks from when we moved from New York to New Mexico in every place we stopped, and then I got into collecting coins and stamps and all kinds of other crap like Pogs and Magic the Gathering cards. And when I was about, I want to say 11 or 12 years old, a friend of mine gave me Green Day's Insomniac on cassette tape.
Ah.
And that tape led to me being a collector of music. And I was a big cassette tape guy. I used to make mixtapes in my bedroom and pretend that I was a DJ and talk in between songs. And that eventually led to me interning at a radio station when I lived out on Guam. And that kind of put me into the realm of music professionally. And I started to have a bigger understanding of how I wanted to fit into that world, because I didn't want to just be a DJ, and I didn't want to perform either. I wasn't necessarily in the mindset of writing music and wanting to perform, although I played. I could never find a collective of individuals who shared the same amount of drive and passion for the projects that I was wanting to pursue. So I stepped into the behind-the-scenes roles when I moved back to Colorado and started booking concerts, which led to me tour managing and eventually led to me doing more artist management work.
Well, let's talk about Insomniac, because a lot of people right after Dookie came out were angry that Green Day got so angry, and Armitage Shanks, and that record straight through is so fucking good, and it had, I believe, like 4 or 5 hits it too, but it's oft overlooked, as they say. I mean, Brain Stew, Jaded, Walking Contradiction, Geek Stink Breath, like, that record's so good.
It's chock full of hits that I really never felt got the recognition it deserved. I don't think Green Day really took off as being like a national name until Nimrod. You know, just like Blink-182 got more notoriety for Venom of the State than they did Dude Ranch or Cheshire Cat. In that same realm, it's just, it wasn't a mainstream staple yet. I don't think that people were ready to digest that sound.
Well, I mean, Good Riddance, I believe it was in the finale of Seinfeld, which is probably about as big as it gets. And what's funny is, I mean, I'm a few years older than you, so it kind of makes sense. Dookie was one of the first cassettes that I bought with my own money. I mean, when I say my own, I say like my allowance money. But I had the cassette, Dookie, and that album changed my life, and I love I love Green Day. I guess let's fuck your career and fuck my career. Like, what's your favorite Green Day record? I want to hear this. I'm very curious.
I'd probably have to say Insomniac, just because I'd listened to it so thoroughly. And I'm a big fan of Nimrod too, but I feel like after Nimrod came out, I started to be introduced to heavier bands and heavier music, like Under Oath or It Dies Today, and then that style have just engulfed my whole.
Well, I hear that in
my
Rain.
Whole presence, yeah.
I definitely do hear that in the band Rain, but like, what's crazy is a lot of people. I actually was talking about this with my last show with Brad Dillon, but I mean, a lot of people in our age bracket really just stopped discovering music and are really entrenched with what they loved in the past. And I know that you and I are both, I guess, exceptions to that because we listen to a lot of current stuff. But Dookie is still my favorite because that was my gateway drug to Green Day. And while I do love Insomniac, Nimrod, and I'll go on record and say that American Idiot and 21st Century Breakdown are masterpieces as well, Dookie is just the album for me that I can always listen to straight through without any stops. So that
I feel
that.
Like that's a rarity too, is these days is a lot of bands don't write an album that you can really listen to from start to finish like you used to be able to, say, 10 to 15 years ago. I feel like music being accessible on the internet has made it so that people are writing songs quicker but not actually thinking about the composition and having substantial enough songwriting behind it, you know? So it's more singles and more EPs versus full-length albums that have proper time to write, you know? And that's the thing, like with Paris, for example, the band Paris, their first full-length album was written over a collective of time, you know? So the songwriting on it is pristine, and that album is one of the few albums I feel that has come out recently that you can put on, start to finish, and not have to skip a song. You know, there's no filler.
Well, you have your whole life to write your first album, right? And then if that album does well, like kind of like Weezer's Blue album, you know, then you have more of a rush time, and obviously the label, or if you're not even on a label. Yeah, there's so many expectations and there's money behind it, but I mean, yeah, you're right. And now bands nowadays aren't even, sometimes they're not even getting offered album deals. Sometimes they're getting offered singles deals, which is just like blowing my mind from the kid who would listen to Beatles albums start to finish and Dookie and the Blue album and, you know, everything. So,
yeah, I remember writing a paper on the whole concept of the internet when it became more prevalent as being something that, like, the mainstream public had access to, and Napster. And I remember Napster and LimeWire being such a huge issue, but at the same time, it was making music so much more accessible internationally to people who probably would have had to wait maybe a year or two to hear it. I mean, considering I was living down by Guam on a little island that had minimal exposure to mainstream media, except for you know, the TV that was delayed 2 weeks, recorded and then sent out and broadcast again. But I remember hearing Linkin Park's One Step Closer and immediately finding it on LimeWire and downloading it. And then having my grandmother special order the CD Hybrid Theory and mail it all the way across the world to me.
That's pretty wild. Like, well, specialing order, like I would special. Well, yeah, the internet made that possible. It's like I remember special ordering Thrice's Illusion of Safety because most mainstream record stores wouldn't carry it. But I've never even thought about this, how like somewhere like Guam or somewhere in a random island in the middle of nowhere would have to special order a major label record. That just blows my mind, like, because like that was what Linkin Park was in the 2000s was what Nirvana was for like kids our age. So it's just pretty wild.
It was really strange to be landlocked on this 14-by-17-mile island, and I still kept in touch with my friends in the U.S. about what are you listening to, what movies are you checking out, and I wanted to be involved with what was happening, you know, with my peers, and my friends down there on the islands, like, they listened to hip-hop, and they listened to island reggae, and it wasn't really like... Even bands like Blink-182 and Sum 41, like, as they started to break into radio, I was interning at the radio station, and my program director had no interest in putting these singles into rotation, even though they were charting, you know, in the top 50 songs in the U.S. It just didn't have the demographic that it needed to really be embraced out there. And I remember being in ninth grade, and the guy who helped me, Galvin Guerrero, helped me get an internship at this radio station. He told me if I maintained a B average that I could go in and I could learn about broadcasting and learn about voiceover work and doing all kinds of stuff from programming to making commercials. And that was a very cool experience, but I remember being so confused as to why they weren't, you know, playing these singles that were in the top 10 on TRL back in the day, you know. And I get it now, but back then I was very confused as to why they weren't exposing people to this music. And it is a very different thing when you're in a different country and stuff that is very popular in your home country has no real significance where you are. And it was very interesting to be that person who was introducing these people to this music. Like, I would DJ during our lunch basketball games, and I would play hip-hop, and I would also mix in metal. And it was very, we called it b-ball jams, and it was a lunchtime thing every Wednesday while I was going to this Catholic private school. And that was kind of where I started my interest again with DJing and playing music and more as like a performer. And I started a business where I would DJ school dances and house parties. And that was kind of what I did. And then it turned into so much more. I had no idea, like 15 years later, that I would still be very passionately pursuing music.
Well, what's interesting is you just made me realize two different points. I mean, okay, let's just talk about nationally, because obviously each state right now has a completely different stereotype. And I grew up on Long Island on the East Coast, completely opposite coast to where I live now in Los Angeles, 3,000 miles away. And when they played on the influential radio stations out there, they played like Sublime, they played No Doubt, they played Bad Religion. None of that stuff was big on the East Coast at all around that time. I mean, it eventually got there, but like, what was big on the radio where I live, believe it or not, was they would play a lot of Nirvana, but Dave Matthews Band was like the biggest thing on the planet there. And
Blues Traveler.
Blues Traveler. Oh my God, dude. And what's even nuts about Blues Traveler, which blows my mind, is at the time, Blues Traveler could have sold out Madison Square Garden like that. I just saw them at the House of Blues in Anaheim. They couldn't sell it out. Now.
Easy. Yeah, no. It's crazy to think, though, because back then, when music was played on one coast, like K-Rock in L.A. would break a band, and it would take probably a month before East Coast stations picked up the single.
If they did.
At least.
If they did.
It at all.
Yeah. Right. It just blew my mind. Like, I mean, because, like, bands, like, even, here's another one that's, because K-Rock, obviously, that's the one I'm exposed to. Like, Social Distortion out here in Los Angeles is the kind of place where I could like, throw a quarter down the sidewalk and hit someone with a Social Distortion tattoo. Whereas on the East Coast, yeah, they're big, but it's just, like, they're not going to be playing venues maybe one-fourth of their size on the East Coast than they are here. It's just pretty amazing. So bands like Linkin Park are the ones that just have universal global appeal everywhere. I mean, you're probably the one who kickstarted their movement in Guam, so props to you for that. But I mean, I'm going to give you that ownership. I'm going to say that Robinanda is the reason why Linkin Park sold a ticket in Guam. So thank you for that. And Guam thanks you too. So I guess, I had no idea. I mean, because like when I spoke with you on the phone, like obviously both of us speak with people up and down the industry, being artist managers first. You speak with people that kind of stammer and are kind of awkward, and you're not. You're very personal.
No.
So I appreciate that, and indeed. I think that's showing. Well, thank you for that, because you're making this interview go by a lot quicker, and you're also, showcasing your depth of field, if you will. So I guess, what was the gateway from being Mixmaster Robinanda to where you are right now?
Well, when I moved back to Colorado, I was 18, and my parents had just gotten divorced. I was starting school in Fort Collins, and
Blasting Room. Blasting Room. That's all I think about. That's rad.
Yep, Bill and Jason, great folks. That's a great, great, great studio. Multiple records have been
quite a few
made
quite
there.
A few. Yeah.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time there. My buddy Adam used to be a drum engineer there. And,
Holy shit!
The band I manage, Head Injuries, actually recorded their full length there while I didn't remember it was doing Bad Vibrations at the same
Holy
time.
Fuck, dude! All I think about are like Descendants and Rise Against. Like that's amazing. That's some history.
Yeah. It's one of the shows I booked back in the day too was a MySpace secret show for Rise Against a long time ago in collaboration with a venue that is. Changed multiple names over the last decade, but I moved to Colorado and I was in school and I wanted to get back into broadcasting, but I didn't have any professional schooling. Like I had my air check tape, took it to a couple program directors.
You think I got schooling, yo? I got no schooling in broadcast. I have an English degree. I got this shit by my wits, son. Anyway, continues.
Yeah, well, I started working with a production company that did a lot of metal concerts locally in Northern Colorado, and that transitioned to me doing lights and doing a lot of street team work. And eventually the venues took note that I had a lot of relations with local talent and gave me a couple of dates of my own. And that started my journey as a talent buyer and a promoter. And then over 2006 to 2010, I booked multiple national tours in Fort Collins and built a very, very, very supportive scene. With several local artists who were all very driven on supporting that scene, which allowed me to then bring in more national talent and package them with my locals. And it was all a very, very big learning experience. I learned a lot. I made some mistakes, but I also made very, very, very good relationships with a lot of bands. And one of those bands was a band called No Bragging Rights from Riverside.
Pure Noise, right?
They were signed to Pure Noise Records.
Yep.
Jake Brown's label. And I booked them probably 6 or 7 times all over Colorado, and they finally were like, yo, dude, just come out and work with us. We can't pay you much. We'll give you $10 a day, and you can do lights and handle our settlements. And I said, okay, let's go.
Well, I just want to interrupt you quickly on that, because we talk about this a lot on the show, how there's no job too small if you want to break into the industry. And the prerequisite that they said to you was, you know, we're not going to pay you that much. But when you're starting out and you don't have much of a pedigree, you do that. When I go to Warped Tour, I see Kevin Lyman picking up cigarette butts from the ground. He is clearly, quote unquote, above that. But you need to grind it out and show that you could be the jack of all trades before you get to point A or point B. So props to you for doing that, because it is not a pretty life being on the road with even if you're talking about like a mid-level Pure Noise band, they're not making that much money. So clearly you're not going to be making that much. You're going to have to grind it out.
Right. And I think that's a big thing that like the general public doesn't understand is the overhead expenses that it takes to be a touring band and actually be consistently on the road. It's not easy. It definitely seems to require more of a developmental stage for a lot of these bands before they actually start making money and start kind of covering their expenses and being able to offer a more realistic pay for their crew. And I wouldn't change it for the world. I feel like half of the experience I've done has made me better at what I do now. And there's certain situations that if I were in now without that experience, I probably would have handled very differently. And I definitely look at every experience that I've had to get to where I'm at now as a learning experience that has taught me how to handle my business now in a much better fashion.
Well, I can tell you, because I used to be a full-time artist before I was an artist manager, and the way that I was able to gain my clients' trust was being like, no, I grinded it out in bands. I've done this. I've started from a band with nothing and got record deal A, so that's how you gain the trust of people, as opposed to just being like the kind of kid who moves to Los Angeles and wants Taylor Swift to open for him. And it's just like,
right, it's not realistic.
It's that I always say that management is doing the impossible for the ungrateful. That's the slogan I like to say. So there you go.
That's a good way of looking at it.
Thank you.
That's a very good way of looking at it. Because, I mean, a lot of what we do as managers is never really perceived as being something we've done. It's more so a reflection of what our artists are doing. But nobody really realizes, again, like the general public doesn't see that there's someone in an office dedicating 14 to 16 hours of their day to phone calls and emails to make possibilities happen.
To unbillable things. I mean, we could definitely have an entire an entire hour long conversation about venting. So we'll try to be a little positive. But yeah, I mean, I don't charge a retainer. I'm assuming you don't either with that. So it's like I don't bill you for the emails I send out or for the phone calls I have or for the meetings I go on. It's just a crazy world. So we're gonna take a short break. I really appreciate your time, and
you bet.
Stick around. Hello, we are back with Robinanda, where we're just sounding like angry old men complaining about the kids and not understanding what's going on. I really want to know about the Fort Collins scene, because when you said Fort Collins, the first thing that came to my mind was obviously the Blasting Room. But I want to hear about, I guess, because is that a typical tour stop for a lot of bands, or is that more of like a B market?
It's more of a BC market, because it's an hour outside radius clauses for people to be able to play Denver, and it's on the way to Salt Lake or from Nebraska. It's a college town, so it's very supportive of bluegrass and dubstep and independent underground hip-hop like Atmosphere and Sage Francis, whereas metal and punk, it comes in waves. It really, like, there's a period of time when I was doing it from 2006 to 2010 where there was no shortage of bands that I could use as local support, whereas now a lot of the offers that I get for tour packages that need dates, I have to place them in Denver because the local options in Fort Collins are so either punk left field or indie right field. Like, there's no real heavy aggressive locals. There's a few, you know, they're few far between, and a lot of the bands are still developing themselves. It's like a resurgence almost, where it comes in waves. The bands are doing really well and then they disband and form new projects, and it's interesting. It can be very supportive though, and it can be a very, very, very cool scene to be with, but there's also times where it's like, what is going on here? Like, why is there no local music? And as much as there is like a supportive community, there's the woman who has the hospital or the patent on the hospital bed. She's a Fort Collins native, and she donates a huge portion of her multi-million-dollar profits to the local community, and twice a year pays for staging and national talent to come in and do this local free festival that's a family event. Like, every year there's a thing called New West Fest in the fall and the Taste of Fort Collins in early summertime, but I've helped build the production a couple times now and set the stages up, and I do that from time to time as well. But they've brought in, I mean, most recently I think we had Cake headline New West Fest.
I love Cake. Sacramento's
they did Fashion Nugget start to finish.
Oh dude, oh my god, Frank Sinatra, man,
it was awesome.
Oh yep. That's I hear that they're exceptionally good live too. I mean, no one sounds like that band at all.
They are, for being as old of a band as they are, they like played at 10 o'clock. They put on a full hour and a half long set. They didn't look super tired, and they looked like they were having fun.
So they were hungry for Cake.
They still
dude.
Got it.
They're hungry.
They still got it.
That's awesome. I mean, and then they have definitely paid their dues. They have quite a few hits. I mean, I think that record and then the next two at least had one hit from it each. So good on them.
Right.
And good on, I mean, it's crazy because they're the kind of band that I don't know if a major label would take a chance on now, because it's just like, this is so weird and left of center. And props to whoever signed. I think they were on like Capricorn or whatever, but they had.
They're staying busy. I mean, and she likes to pick up talent that is more nostalgic than anything else. Like a couple years back, she had Smash Mouth come out, and you've heard the national news about Steve getting crazy, and I like to say he had a crummy attitude because
was that the YouTube one? Was that the one where he had a shit fit? Oh, was that was there?
Yeah, that was it. Taste of Fort Collins a couple years back.
Oh god.
And he was hammered like when he got there, and one of the local vendors was giving out loaves of bread for free. So when he went on his rant and lost his shit, everybody decided to throw loaves of bread at him. So
like Trump throwing tissue paper. Oh my god.
Exactly. But I made a meme at the time and said he had a crummy attitude.
Wah. Well, listen, I don't know if you read my Facebook, but I'm sponsored by Dad Jokes. So I appreciate you saying the crummy attitude. And for the record, Smash Mouth is the Beatles of our time. So I guess if people were to talk – I'm kidding. So if people were to talk about you and they were going to, read an epitaph, we can get really fucking morbid here. What would be your primary source of income? Besides, you know, being the Smash Mouth fan club president.
It varies because I do make income from a full-time job where I work at a dispensary here in Colorado.
They have that there? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, there's a couple.
I like that stuff.
But I work for a very cool company here that has been super flexible with me leaving for tours. That's been a blessing, but that's more recent. I mean, I've done a lot over the last decade just strictly with it. And I mean, it's been a very, very, very big uphill climb because there was a day when I was making $10 a day, and now I have a minimum and I won't go on the road for anything less because it's hard to be away so frequently. You don't necessarily have to be, whereas a band member has to do every tour because they're performing, you know. Like, I'm the behind-the-scenes guy. They could put someone else in my seat at time. And I've, over the years, just realized I would spend more time taking care of my own self and my own life.
You're married, dude. My future. You're married. Right. You and I are – we have someone else in our lives that's the thing. It's – the touring, you can do it, and that's why we give bands like Cake – I mean, this is a perfect segue, but this is why we give them a lot of credit, because touring's a young man's game. I mean, people don't even realize this, but the Beatles were fed up with touring. They weren't even around for 10 years. I mean, it's just crazy. For bands like Aerosmith and the Stones to have this career as long as they've had, it's amazing. But people, there's only so many times you could sleep on motel floors, or not even a motel, or on the floor of some shithole apartment on $100 guarantee that you have to split with five dudes. So some people just can't do it forever, and you have
I think for me, your life. It's like being a 21-year-old and going into the touring world, you don't have a lot holding you back, whereas me now being almost 32, 10 years later, I'm married to the girl that I was dating back then, and she's gone to nursing school, and I needed to help her through that, and she supported me when I wanted to go and make $10 a day and go on a van with a bunch of smelly dudes for months at an end. And now it's kind of like, well, on the end of the coin, there's more to life than going on every tour you get offered. I got to a point where I had to decide if I wanted to just solely base my own personal income off of touring, or if I wanted to try to have a home job that I could work at in between tours. And for a long time, I was very resistant of the idea, and it drove my wife nuts. She was like, you got to do something. Like, you're going to drive yourself nuts being home, and you're going to drive me nuts by being home and not doing anything. So it
kind
of came to a point where it, like, literally had to, you know, compromise. And coincidentally, I had something happen where I legally had to be home for a period of time. I got a marijuana DWAI in the state of Colorado.
Whoa. We did not expect to do some muckraking on this show. I've never even heard of that.
That's real. It's a very real thing. I mean, and the way the constitutes are set up in the state of Colorado are different than the rest of the country that is looking at marijuana as being a medicine. But we enforced a law that basically states that 5 active nanograms is considered intoxication, but for anybody who smokes pot, they know that it stays in your system for a an abundance of time and you're not high. Like, I can have it in my system, but that doesn't mean I'm high.
Right.
So I got...
That's what drug tests do.
An example.
It's not like when you get a drug test for a job, you go in there all methed out. You know, you might have used that meth the day before.
Right.
Fuck. I'm sorry you had to deal with that.
Yeah, I brushed my teeth with it yesterday, but... Yeah, I mean, it got to a point where I could tour. My probation officer didn't say I couldn't leave the state, but they said that if you want to leave the state, you're going to have to check in with a probation officer in every state that you're in. And it just, for me, it was like, oh my God, how am I going to do that on top of taking care of 9 guys and doing everything I need to do?
That's a logistical nightmare, man. I mean, I just want to say thank you for being probably one of the most candid people on this show. I've had people actually say we don't want to talk about certain things, but... I mean, obviously, you're not talking about a Megan's Law type offense. You're talking about something that is, honestly, like, obviously, you shouldn't drive stoned or drunk. Like, that's true. But I appreciate you being really open about that. And, I mean, what's crazy is that was, that pitfall, pun intended, possibly, unintentionally changed your life scope, though, to being where you're...
It really did.
Yeah, so...
It really did, because... That happened in November of 2014. I had just finished a tour with a band that still owes me a substantial amount of money.
Well, fuck them. Sorry, I'll say that on the air.
They suck, and that's okay. That's not a big deal.
This band is called Leonard Skinnerd, by the way. Leonard Skinnerd really fucked Robinanda over. They did not have enough money from Sweet Home Alabama to pay him, and they owe him a substantive amount.
They owe me money. No, it basically turned into a situation where it was a blessing in disguise, because that happened, and then I got the DUI, and then I was like, well, how the fuck am I going to pay for this if I can't even tour? Like, that's been my sole source of income. And a blessing in disguise was, on that tour, I had the fortunate opportunity of meeting a gentleman by the name of Thomas Pridgen. Shortly after that tour, for those of you who don't know, Thomas Pridgen is a Grammy Award-winning drummer who won a Grammy for his work with the Mars Volta, and he's drummed with Suicidal Tendencies and Trash Talk and Eros Ramazzotti, and he just finished a South American tour with a group called Residente. But long story short, he reached out to me out of the blue after that, said, hey, I'd like you to manage me. I don't think there's anybody better for it. I just want to smoke weed and play drums, and you're really good with people and words, so let's do this.
I mean, that's a hell of a pitch, by the way.
That opportunity in itself.
That's the best pitch. Yeah, I just want to smoke weed and play drums. I think you'd be good to help me with both of those things. You can help me get drum gigs, and you can help me get more weed. Thank you for that.
Yeah, sure. Why not? And that's kind of how it went. And Thomas is just a very easy dude to work with versus being a tour manager where you're dealing with 6 different personalities and schedules, and Thomas is just one person. So this was the first time that I was ever developing and working with an artist that was already established and was just one entity. So that experience, you know, it's kind of been one of those things where he's already a very well notarized artist. People know of him, and he gets several offers, but he doesn't like doing the entertaining of the offers. He doesn't want to have to negotiate. So he just forwards me stuff he's interested in pursuing, and I handle the behind the scenes stuff. And that's how it's been for a little over a year now.
You could be the bad guy, man. That's one of my pitches to the people. It's like, you're not the creative process guy. That the creative fluidity can be obtained with the artist, producer, artist, and whomever. And you could be the one who does the paperwork and handles all the logistics. Yep. And that way, all the relationships are fluid except for the ones in your own brain. So I just want to say one quick thing on this is that when I moved to Los Angeles in 2003, DeLouse at the Comatorium was something that I listened to so many fucking times. So it's pretty rad that you're affiliated with that. So we don't have too much time left. So I guess give your roster of people that you manage shout outs. As many as you want, because the floor is yours. I want, if anyone's listening to this, to check out what you do and who you work with.
So Thomas Pridgen is my primary client. Keeps me really busy, and he does a lot of studio work, and he gigs and does clinics and does lessons, and occasionally will go out as a drummer for hire if the vibe is right. I also
for hire
Evolve Music
get it?
Management.
I'm sorry. I mean, if we're gonna go with the dad joke, hire.
Get it?
Just remember that zing.
Higher.
Yeah, bro.
You're great.
Thank you. Once in a while.
I also do stuff with Mike Zimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Third String Productions and Third String Festivals. I work for his management company. I'm the vice president of operations of Evolve Music Management with a collective of other awesome artist managers. Check out Evolve Music Management, all of our artists. I personally represent a deathcore band from Austin, Texas. Just finished a East Coast tour with a couple of bands, and they are getting to back into Texas actually today to start work on their next album. And I also kind of do consultation for a few other acts, mostly just unofficial, just kind of help them out with their plans and scheduling and coordination of their goals and making sure that they're realistically setting up goals they can achieve.
Well, that's what artist management is, dude. I mean, artist management is, in addition to that, is managing expectations. So that's a huge part of it, because everyone expects
that's a lot of it. That's a lot of it. And like establishing communication so that I can understand an artist's expectations and then go to work in terms of developing and manifesting what they want to achieve. It's just, that's what we do. And we put the puzzle together is the best way I can say that.
I've never looked at it that way. That's another good way. I feel like we're just looking at it in every best way possible. So thank you for that. So
there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, and like we're the one who kind of has to put them together, from seeking out a booking agent or support options for tours or
marketing,
utilizing the other connections we have with other artist managers to get their bands on our tours. It's just all networking and kind of being able to use those relationships to push forward with your individual client's goals.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? And it's the thing is that the days that I wake up where I'm like, oh, I have the least amount of stuff to do, are the days where the most shit explodes in my face. It's pretty nuts. So I guess, I mean, you just did a really good job of giving people shout outs, but how can people check you out on social media? Talk about whatever you want.
Everywhere.
Yeah, you are literally everywhere. Like, talk about whatever you want.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and my name is one of a kind. So it's just look up Rabananda if you want to see what I'm up to and where I'm at, and check out my posts and awesome. There's a lot of pictures of my dog. I love my dog a lot.
Duke's and you love best. Your shout wife too. To just shout out to you because I give. My wife, Kelly, who I'm going to say her name again, Kelly, as many shout outs as possible, because without her, I wouldn't have the emotional support to pursue this crazy thing. So it's rad that you have someone in your life.
Half the time I'm sitting there, you know, just as well as I do, half the time we're sitting there with a dilemma or a situation where we're like, does this sound crazy to anyone else besides me? And they're the voice of reason. You know, my wife, Kirsten, has been, she knows more about this music industry than anybody I know because of the amount of bullshit that she's had to put up with over the last decade. And she's probably, like they say, it's like behind every successful man is an even more successful and supportive woman. And that's the truth. I mean, Kirsten makes my life so much easier. And when I'm having a rough day, like, she's the one who kind of helps me reel it in and regain my focus and passion. Like, there's been a couple times in the last few months where I've been really burnt out and just not motivated. And I've had to kind of take a step back and reinvent the way that I look at my passion to make sure that I'm not unmotivated to do the things that I need to do for my clients and still enjoy doing it.
And the disconnection is so necessary. I talk about this all the time. Like, obviously, it's good to have a sounding board and what you said, you know, behind every successful man, successful woman, and vice versa, too. But, you know, sometimes to just, like, put your phone on airplane mode and just to watch a stupid freaking movie on Netflix with your wife, or just go for a walk and just talk about things that have nothing to do with music, because if you don't recharge, you're going to get so fucking burnt out. I've seen so many people burn themselves out in this, and it's bad. It's bad for everyone around you.
Okay. There's an expectation within the music industry that responses are done, you know, same day, if not same hour or same minute. Like, text messages come in, I usually respond immediately. I'm very good about it, and it drives me nuts when people don't. But I have to understand that that's the next message I'll do, and everybody else is going to do the same. So being able to turn myself off, put my phone in airplane mode, not check my email every 15 minutes, and immerse myself in making dinner or watching a movie or going for a walk, like you said, that's super important.
Well, I appreciate you stressing that importance. This is going to be you know the show Chopped? This is going to be the most Chopped episode of Waldman's Words. So if you want to sound off with some weird auto-tune, I give you permission for doing this show. I hope that you have a good rest of your day slash week with the misses. And I guess if you have one piece of advice for someone who wants to do the 83 million hyphens that you do and live in the 733 countries that you've lived in, what would you say?
I would probably say that it's all about learning as much as you can. The thing you know everything is the second that you will start to fail. Like, you have to be open-minded enough to see the lessons when they're there, and you have to be able to stay humble enough to take a lesson that might be painful to experience and see it as a lesson and view it as a lesson and then apply it to bettering yourself for future opportunities. It's just stay on the horse. If you fall off, get back on it. Stay humble. Learn from everything as much as you can.
I mean, I just want people to be more humble. See, now I'm losing track of my own self, but more humble on Facebook. Oh my God, that pisses me off. Anyway, so let's end on a positive note. You're a nice person. You're a smart guy. I appreciate your time. Oh, that sounded so sincere. Thank you. So have a great day. You're great.
You too, Scott.
Have a good day.
No, thank you for your time, man. I'm sorry about the issues with the connection, but Emily, I promise there's going to be an apple pie with some ice cream.
And weed. Have a good day.
You too, Scott. Thanks for your time, man.
Later.